Charlottesville Tomorrow, an advocate for our future today. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonpartisan community organization working on land use, transportation, and community design issues. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org.
On October 1, 2013, Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress co-sponsored a candidate forum for the two candidates seeking election to the Samuel Miller District seat on the Albemarle Board of Supervisors. The Republican incumbent candidate is Dwayne Snow, and the Democratic challenger is Liz Palmer. Four of the six magisterial district seats on the board will be determined in the November 5th election. About 50 local residents came to Murray Elementary School to hear the candidates respond to questions posed by the sponsors, the audience, and each other. My name is Brian Wheeler with Charlottesville Tomorrow, and this evening we are co-hosting, along with the Daily Progress, this candidate forum for the two people seeking election to the Samuel Miller district seat on the Albemarle Board of Supervisors. Those candidates are Republican incumbent Dwayne Snow and the Democratic challenger Liz Palmer. Four of the six seats on the board will be on the ballot November 5th. Now, before I tell you about the format for tonight's forum, I want to make sure you know about Charlottesville Tomorrow and our partnership with the Daily Progress. Charlottesville Tomorrow is an information resource covering growth, development, education, local politics. We are nonpartisan, we are a nonprofit organization, and we do not endorse anybody. Our goal is to help you make an informed choice on both the issues and the candidates. And tonight we'd appreciate getting you on our email list. We're going to pass around our clipboard. Dan has the clipboard right there. He's going to start with the front row. We'll pass that around. If you're already on our email list, you don't need to sign up again. So this will be for newcomers. Now, our partnership with the Daily Progress goes back to 2009. Anita Shelburne is with us tonight, and she is the newspaper's editorial page editor, and she's going to help moderate the forum tonight. Our two organizations collaborate in many ways to get you in-depth local news. Charlottesville Tomorrow's contribution has been over 1,000 news stories over the past 4 years contributed to the newspaper. The newspaper contributes in many ways, one of which is the printing of our local election voter guides. And this year, I'm pleased to say we're partnering also with the League of Women Voters on the voter guide. This will be mailed to every household with a vote in all four districts that are voting in the upcoming election. We also do one for the city of Charlottesville. The community's lucky to have a newspaper willing to partner with organizations like ours and make sure that you get as much in-depth local news as possible. So let me talk about the format tonight. The candidates will begin by introducing themselves with an opening statement. Then we're going to go through seven questions that the newspaper and Charlottesville Tomorrow have come up with. And both candidates will be asked the same questions. The balance of that time will be for your questions. You should have seen cards and pens as you walked in. If not, if you need one, you can just raise your hand, and Dan Henneke will hand you a card and a pen. We'd love to get your questions on the table here. Anita Shelburne with the newspaper will screen those questions, so we will not be taking questions live directly from the audience. You write them down, submit them to Anita, and she's going to pick seven and give those to me. Throughout the forum, I will announce how much time the candidates have for our responses. For their responses, our volunteer, Angela Lynn, is in the front row, and she'll be keeping time directly in front of the candidates. A yellow card indicates the candidates have 30 seconds, and a red card indicates they should stop. We expect the forum to run till about 8 o'clock tonight. Finally, again, our goal is to help you make an informed decision. If your question is not addressed tonight, I would encourage you to seek an answer directly from our local candidates here. One of the great things about politics in Charlottesville, Albemarle, is that our candidates are very accessible. So if you need an answer that you haven't gotten before you make your vote, I'd encourage you to reach out to the candidates and get that answer. With that, I'll ask the audience to silence your mobile phones and candidates to silence your mobile phones. Oh, I silenced mine. Angela has my phone. We'll begin with the opening statements, and Dwayne Snow, by the flip of a coin, drew first. So, Mr. Snow, you have 3 minutes for your opening statement.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to express my appreciation to Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress for having this forum, and each of you for coming out on a night like this and to participate in this forum. 4 years ago, when I made the decision to run, it was a hard decision. I wasn't sure that this was something that I wanted to do. But the more I thought about the situation that I felt like the county was in, for example, we had been discussing the several projects, the building of roads, the building of a dam, for all these things have been going on for 30 to 40 years. We had spent tons of money in studies, and it just didn't seem like we were getting anywhere. So that was one of the things I wanted to do, to see what I could do to come in and make a difference. Another item that was on my list was an economic development plan. It didn't seem to me that there was a so-called economic development statement. But, you know, a plan is not a plan unless you have some action steps to go with it. And so I'm happy to say that over the last 4 years, we now have a genuine economic development plan along with action steps to go with it. I heard the story right before I decided to run. There was a gentleman that has a business in town. Most of you would probably know him. But he was asked to someone on the county board of supervisors where he should locate his business. And he was told, locate it in the city. We don't need your business. Well, frankly, you know, our area is continuing to grow, and we do need to have good jobs, career ladder type jobs, so that we can have positions for our children, our grandchildren, and those that want to stay here in this area. I was talking with a gentleman the other day, and it emphasizes the need to have an economic development plan. Was I asked him how much he was making, and he told me the story he was working at, and he said, I'm making $7.80 an hour. And I thought to myself, you can't live on $7.80 an hour. But as we bring in additional well-paying jobs that, and we grow them organically through the things that the university is producing, we can have good career ladder jobs and be able to raise the overall wages in this area. Another thing that was important to me was that we were entering a time, it seemed like our taxes were constantly going up, and it was very important to me that we start curbing our taxes and watch the economic. We wanted to work on economic development growth, but the thing I was concerned about is that the taxes seem to be going up continually, and I'll talk more about that later.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, you have 3 minutes for an opening statement.
Okay. I also want to thank everybody for coming here, and I want to thank Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress for hosting this event. Since I'm the newcomer here, I thought I would tell you a little bit about myself. We have a qualification section later. I've been a practicing veterinarian for over 30 years. In 2008, I started a mobile practice, Charlottesville End-of-Life Pet Care, where I take care of animals at their end of life and do pain management. My husband, Herb Stewart, is a clinical psychologist at Western State Hospital. We live in Ivy. I have 4 children. 2 I gave birth to, and 2 I acquired. I call them my bonus children. My sister died when her child was 8, so I helped raise him. And my husband's first wife died when their child was 5, and so I took her on when I was 10. So the kid, when she was 10, so the kids went to Western Albemarle High School, Henley, Meriwether Lewis, Crozet. So I'm very familiar with the schools here. I moved here in 1996 to join my parents, who had lived here since 1975. I became active in local issues in 1997 when I was hiking with my children along the Mormons River. I was stunned to see that 3 miles of the river below the Sugar Hollow Dam was dry. Water was being piped to Ragged Mountain Reservoir, but a lot was being wasted because of poorly maintained, antiquated infrastructure. And there was no plans to fix it, no money to fix it with. This started me on a 14-year journey to get to get a 21st century water supply plan adopted so that our people would have the water that they needed and the rivers would be protected. I was appointed to the County Water Board in 2006 by then Supervisor Sally Thomas, who is now serving as my campaign manager. I was reappointed in 2010 by Dwayne Snow. Thank you, Dwayne.
You're welcome.
We were successful in getting a water supply plan through in 2011. We brought the business and the environmental community together and also city and county together with a final plan. For me, the most fun and interesting part of running for office is going door to door and hearing people's concerns. It's clear from those who I've spoken with that education is a top priority, and I'm proud to say that I have been endorsed as the pro-education candidate in this race by the Albemarle Education Association. And I'm really looking forward to all tonight's questions, including the questions I get from Dwayne. Thank you.
Thank you. Is the volume okay on everybody? Okay. We begin the question and answer portion with the seven questions that Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress have come up with. The candidates received the topics for these questions in advance. Each candidate will have 2 minutes to respond, and I will repeat the question for each candidate. Dr. Palmer, you'll begin with the first question, and that is, how would you describe the challenges and opportunities facing Albemarle County's rural farms, fields, and forest? Dr. Palmer.
Well, when I talk to farmers, the one thing that I hear the most is the problems with actually getting their products to market. And I think that the food hub has been wonderful in helping with that. So I'm hoping that that will continue and grow and they'll become even more successful than they've already been. As far as the forests are concerned, I think one of the biggest problems with our forests is fragmentation. We think of sprawl in the urban areas, but we really have something sort of similar in the rural areas in that our forests are fragmented. One of the things that we can do is have more conservation easements, expand the ACE program, fund the ACE program, so that we can get more tracts of forests that are contiguous. As far as the fields are concerned, I think the one thing that I hear the most about is that some of our fields have been compacted substantially just by use over the years, and this is actually forming, some of these areas are impermeable surfaces, and we have a lot of runoff from rainwater, and that can cause more sedimentation and entrenching of waterways. So with respect to what to do about that, I think that probably what we would need to do is get the is to support the Thomas Jefferson Soil and Water District in helping farmers solve some of those problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Snow, how would you describe the challenges and opportunities facing Albemarle County's rural farms, fields, and forest? Mr. Snow.
Over the last 4 years, we've been able to bring a lot of additional revenues to farmers by encouraging things such as the Food Hub. For those of you that are not familiar with the Food Hub, it's a process where the farmers can bring their food in and take it out to the local restaurants and schools and things such as that so that they've got a ready market for their product. You know, one of the things that I hear most often, though, as I talk with farmers and as I go to their different seminars and things such as that, is the government regulations. And they feel like that the government regulations is stifling their ability to get a lot of their work to work their farms. And it's going to get worse over the next few years. And so we're hoping that we can work with them and help them to have the money that they need to comply with some of the government regulations that are coming down and also continue to be able to make a living by taking care of their farms. We don't want to, you know, force our farmers off of their property and turn it over to gentleman farmers, the type that move here from New York or some other place, and they put their land in conservation easements without any idea of farming. In fact, one farmer told me here just recently, He said, you know, they're putting their farms in the conservation easements or their agricultural zones, but yet they won't even let us go in and take the hay off of it. They just keep it, you know, there, and so they're getting a tax credit for their for having their farms and agricultural uses, but they're not really farming, and they won't let the farmer come in and work their farm or help them with it. So I think there's some inequities there that we need to take care of to help the farmers.
Thank you. All right, the second question will go first to Mr. Snow. If real estate tax revenues increase, should Albemarle lower its property tax rate? Why or why not, Mr. Snow?
Well, that's, you would think that that would be an easy question to answer, but it's really not. It's incumbent upon those that are in on the Board of Supervisors to make sure that we're spending everyone's money wisely. There's things that we have rated over the last few years in order to make it through this terrible economic times that we faced. And so to say, yes, if the taxes go up, I'll automatically reduce taxes. That may be one thing that we can do. But at the same time, we have rated our capital improvement plan budget dramatically. And so we need to start putting some additional money back into capital improvements so that we get past just the maintenance mode, which we've been able to maintain. But there's other things that need to be accomplished in the community that some of that extra money could go for. I don't think this is an opportunity as the economy improves to all of a sudden start to feel like we've got to start hiring a lot of extra people. When we started coming into this period of time of sad economic conditions, we cut through attrition 66 positions in the county, 66 positions, and we cut over $30 million from the budget. And so you can see that we've got some areas that we need to make sure that we're covering in the future, but we've got to be careful that as we move back into more prosperous times that we don't overspend and let things get away from us like we did in the previous years.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, if real estate tax revenues increase, should Albemarle lower its property tax rate? Why or why not? Dr. Palmer.
Well, I agree with Dwayne. I think it really depends on the situation that is at hand when you make that decision. What's the financial situation of the county? I would, however, like to say that I think that I would like to see us pay more attention to our looking at our property values as a basis for what the taxes are rather than just the rate. We've all seen that in recent times with property values going down, our revenues went down. And that would, and that means we have an unstable source of revenue. So if we paid more attention to what people are actually paying than just the rate, then we really could arrange a situation where we would have a more stable revenue source. But I do think that it is the obligation of every elected official to keep taxes as low as possible. But the real question is, what services do you want, and what do people want? And so I agree, we've gone through some terrible times. We've cut back on a lot of things. We have a tremendous backlog on our infrastructure needs. So at present, I would certainly not want to reduce the rate. We do have, what I hear, approximately a 1% increase in property taxes this coming year, which will give us a little relief. So, but people's actual taxes, if we don't lower the rate, will go up than what they actually pay. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to remind the audience, you can write your questions on our index cards. If you just hold them up, we will come around and pick those up. And if you need a card, you can hold your hand up without a card in it, and we'll put one in it. The third question will go first to Dr. Palmer. Do you support the construction of the Western Bypass of U.S. 29? Why or why not, Dr. Palmer?
Okay, big one. I'm in favor of projects that fight traffic congestion on 29. But I don't favor the way this bypass proposal was forced back on to the table in the midnight vote in June 2011. I also don't favor wasting transportation money, transportation dollars that our area desperately needs on a political project for the governor's friends in Lynchburg. The Western Bypass has always had low priority. That's because compared to other projects, it has the least amount of good for the smallest number of drivers at the greatest expense. And the expense will only increase while we try to fix the problems of the bypass to nowhere, named by Jim Rich, a conservative Republican CTB member. As presently designed, it has terminal problems, no pun intended. One is that just getting onto the southern end will take you up a grade that's greater than climbing up Afton Mountain. That fix will be expensive. Another problem, design changes will need to avoid the historic African American cemetery directly in the project's path. Another, none of the property needed for the projects north of the South Fork Ravana have been purchased yet, so that property won't go cheaply. Another is it puts traffic fumes near children, near school children. At the very least, before we commit $250 million or more to this project, it needs to be compared to other present proposals. And Dwayne could have done this because he sits on the MPO. The comparison would show that it's more effective to build the parallel roads and intersection improvements that help local traffic move more easily through the 29 corridor. And those projects cost $70 million less than the so-called bypass. We should save the money and build the alternatives that work better.
Thank you. Mr. Snow, do you support the construction of the Western Bypass of US 29? Why or why not? Mr. Snow.
Absolutely. Prior to coming on the board, and when I was part of my platform, was that I was interested in four main projects in the county. One was the Hillsdale Extension that ran from Whole Foods up to Rile Road. I was in favor of the widening of 29 from the Ravana River out to Hollymead. And if you'll remember that is where the road goes from six lanes down to four lanes, and that's where the young lady was killed here a while back. So that was another item that we needed. We needed an additional on-ramp onto the 250 bypass, and we needed a solution to hook up to Berkmeyer Drive, Berkmeyer Extended. So those were the four main things that we needed. Had a meeting with Secretary Connaughton, and he said, would you support a bypass if we were to fund it? And I said, no. I said, what we need right now, the whole community is united behind these four projects. And after talking for a little bit, he said, if I gave you those four projects, if we gave the county those four projects, would you support a bypass? Absolutely. So we left that meeting that day without having no idea that this was going to be a done deal. And later we found out that he called and said, we can get you the bypass. We can get you these four projects if you support the bypass. And he said, if you don't, then all these other roads are off the table. Now, you've got to keep in mind, how did the bypass get killed originally? They studied some 24, 25 different scenarios for a bypass, and this was the one they decided on. They purchased about 60% or more of the property for this bypass, and then it was killed one day in a Board of Supervisors meeting without a hearing. I'll tell you more later.
Thank you. All right, the fourth question. We'll start first with Mr. Snow. Name one specific area of the county budget that you are concerned about and tell us why, and do you think it deserves more funding or less? Mr. Snow.
Well, as I said just on the second question, that I felt like the one area that we were had drastically reduced and needed some attention on our budget was the capital improvement part of it. The capital improvement projects. We have basically stripped all the projects that we had on the drawing board, and just to make sure that we're keeping things maintained and that we were able to go ahead and get through the through these rough economic situations that we found ourselves in. So now as the budget starts to improve, we need to put additional money back into the capital improvement budget. With that said, let me just point out one other thing. Another reason that, and it goes along with the budget, we haven't had hardly any money to build sidewalks or any other small transportation things that we had in mind, because when the bypass was killed, the state was angry with us and took away all of our funding. Instead of getting, we're sending 40 to 50 plus million a year or more to the state, and they were giving us 4 million. When the bypass was killed, they reduced us to 300,000 a year. And that wasn't enough to hardly build a mile or two of sidewalks. So that's where I would put my money. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, name one specific area of the county budget that you are concerned about and tell us why. And do you think it deserves more funding or less? Dr. Palmer.
Well, I'm actually going to go with the same thing that Dwayne had, which was the backlog of infrastructure that we have. It's quite high in the schools. The thing that I'd like to say about how the county handled the recession, at the Alamar County Service Authority, the County Water Board, a lot of people don't know that that's a separate financial, a separate legal entity. So all of our finances are separate, unlike, for instance, the schools, where they get their money from the county. We, through very careful financial planning, were able to position ourselves to put more infrastructure projects during this recession than we had in the couple of decades prior. And we did that because we maintained a significant reserve fund, we maintained an excellent credit rating, and we developed a water pricing structure that generated a consistent revenue stream. And we also did all that and keeping water rates relatively flat during the recession. And that's not what the county did. They didn't have enough reserves to continue their capital improvements plan, and I think that could have been done better. But that being said, now we have a significant backlog. That's what I would like to pay attention to. I'd also like to just mention that the $300,000 that Dwayne is referring to with respect to the roads was for a secondary road program. We were getting at one point, we were getting about $5 million for secondary roads. And that's a separate pot of money than what you get for the primary road constructions with respect to the bypass. And with the secondary road funds, they all went down during the recession for
Thank
all
you.
Localities.
All right, the fifth question. Keep in mind, if you've written out your question, we will pick those up, so just hold those cards up. This is a wordy one, so bear with me here. This will go first to Dr. Palmer. Business leaders and social service agencies have told the Albemarle Board of Supervisors that new investments are sorely needed in the area of early childhood education. Will you make pre-K education and quality child care a priority, and if so, how? Dr. Palmer.
Well, the answer is, will I make it a priority? Yes. Everyone, I think, except those who fund education, seem to agree that we handicap children if we don't start them out in early education. This can include time spent on a father's lap when he reads. But when it isn't happening, that child gets behind before she even starts. So Bright Stars is a success in this community. That's a early childhood education program. And the Curry School ranked it as one of the best for outcomes when they looked at all the programs in the state that the state funds in something called the Virginia Preschool Initiative. But there's no new funding from the state to address the fact that our waiting list grows every year for Bright Stars. Children are missing out while we wait for the state to provide more funding. So when we know what works, we should make sure it doesn't die just because the state doesn't follow through. We should work to pressure the state, and then we should find the money within our own budget if we can't get it from the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Snow, business leaders and social service agencies have told the Albemarle Board of Supervisors that new investments are sorely needed in the area of early childhood education. Will you make pre-K education and quality child care a priority, and if so, how? Mr. Snow.
I have been making it a priority. I have visited all the schools in my district since I've been in office. If our young children start off early with getting a good education, we cut back on crime, we produce more effective leaders and citizens for our area. I feel very strongly about that. I voted to fund additional money for Bright Stars and fully support Head Start. I think these are valuable things for our kids to be involved in. And it's always number one on my mind when it comes to education is that these kids are our future. And if they are educated properly, and they start going into second, third, and fourth grade, and haven't been labeled that they're ignorant or dumb, then they have a chance to go ahead and succeed. If they come into first grade and they're behind grade level with the rest of the kids, then they're in serious trouble. So I strongly support pre-K education. And that is one of the reasons that I've also strongly supported to make sure that our small rural schools are open. And that is another reason why I've worked really closely with Eric Strucko. Whenever we've gone to any of our town hall meetings, I've arranged to have him go with me so that we could hear the concerns of the children together. In fact, Eric wrote a really nice letter of support of the way we've been able to work together over the last 4 years.
Thank you. All right, the sixth question will go first to Mr. Snow. Describe a part of local government that would benefit from increased city and county cooperation and that you would make a priority. Mr. Snow.
That's always a really good question. First of all, let me tell you where our successes are. We have a joint partnership with the city when it comes to jails, libraries. There's a couple of others. They'll come to me in a second. One of the things we decided to do here about 3 years ago was to have a joint meeting with the city. We had the four city council, we had the city councilors and the six board of supervisors, and we went in and we talked about possible ways that we might be able to have an additional joint services together. And so we divided up into a city councilor, a member of the Board of Supervisors, and then we had a staff assigned to us also. We went off, and for about 6 months, we studied that particular area that we were assigned. When we came back after that 6 months, we found that there weren't any really identifiable options that we could really go together on at this point, other than maybe Parks and Recreation, which we're still looking at. But we found for the most part that if any of these items that we were studying would actually cost the citizens of Albemarle County additional taxes. So that's where we are at this point.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, describe a part of local government that would benefit from increased city and county cooperation and that you would make a priority. Dr. Palmer.
Well, we went to this really fun forum. We've been going to so many forums, but one of them was the Tom Tom Festival, where we had several entrepreneurs and young tech entrepreneurs come in and tell us what they wanted in the community. And one of the things that I walked away from there thinking that a sense of place is really important. They need sort of a critical mass of people that are working on the issues that they're working on and trying to start the kinds of companies that they're trying to start. And they talked an awful lot about being able to move from place to place, bicycle routes, meeting places, common places. And it really became evident that it would be wonderful to work with the city to have green corridors, to have bicycle paths, to kind of crack the urban ring that's that we're unable to get through with a bike. Those kinds of alternative transportation things in common places, I think we could really work with the city in planning. And the other thing that's always been near and dear to my heart for many years now is the fact that we have three water authorities. We have a, so I'm giving two. We have a wholesale water authority, the Ravana Water and Sewer Authority, and we have the city and the county, Albemarle County Service Authority. So we have a duplication there of staff, buildings, trucks, all sorts of things. And I think that we have, if we ever could, it would be wonderful to try to combine those. When you think about the system itself, there's 505 connections in just the water systems between the city and the county. The water doesn't know when it crosses the city line. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, the last moderator question and last call for audience questions. So if you've not submitted yours, please raise your hand now and get those in. This one we will start with Dr. Palmer. And perhaps this is one we should have started the whole candidate forum with. Dr. Palmer, please describe your past experience that qualifies you to be on the Albemarle Board of Supervisors. Dr. Palmer.
Okay. Well, I think I have many qualifications that are good for being a supervisor. First, you might not, it might seem strange to say that being a veterinarian is a qualification for being a supervisor, but it is an exercise in daily problem solving, listening to owners' concerns, evaluating clinical data, and then being as compassionate as possible in applying the indicated treatment. My years in the League of Women Voters have been invaluable. I learned the importance of public participation and the citizens' right to know what's going on in government. The League also requires its members to approach problems in an organized and bipartisan way. During my time in the League of Women Natural Resource Committee, we studied water pricing, connection charges, financing, and board structures of water authorities. In 2006, Sally Thomas, then supervisor, appointed me to the Water Board. I asked for that appointment because I wanted to get the authority to do strategic planning and a rate study. Many people don't realize, as I said before, that the Water Board is financially independent of county government, unlike the school board. And so I worked on finances to adopt a methodology that helps growth pay for growth rather than spreading the cost on current ratepayers. And I championed a lifeline rate that keeps prices low to help those with lower incomes to encourage, helps them with lower, people with lower incomes, and it also encourages conservation. And I currently am the vice chair on that board. I also served on other boards like the Ravana Basin Commission, which is a multi-jurisdictional authority that looks at watershed protection and sedimentation in the rural areas. And also worked on the Ravana River Task Force that looked at sedimentation and how we're going to care for the reservoir. And that's it.
Thank you. Mr. Snow, please describe your past experience that qualifies you to be on the Albemarle Board of Supervisors. Mr. Snow.
For 35 years, I ran Snow's Garden Center and Landscape Business. For many of those years, I was also involved in church work and still am for that matter. I've served on various boards and commissions, served on the State Agricultural Council, served as the president of the Rotary Club. And you know what I found in all of this? Not one organization, not one group of people has a lock on all the good people or on the good ideas. And I think that one of my primary abilities is the ability to listen to all factions and be able to glean the good ideas from the different people and be able to help build a consensus and to move things forward. If you notice over the last 4 years that my vote has been based on issue, my votes have been issue-based and have not been politically based. And to me, that is one of the most important criterias that I think a supervisor needs. If you're to move the community forward, you've got to be able to listen to all sides and then make and help everyone to come together so that you can make a decision that will help the community as a whole.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for sitting through our moderator questions. Now we'll get to your questions. Thank you. And this is the handwriting test. Let's see how I do here. All right, the first audience question will go to Mr. Snow. And that is, can you name three things you do not like about the comprehensive plan, and please describe them? Mr. Snow.
Excuse me a second. The current comprehensive plan, I think, has things that we need to look at, and we are getting ready to completely redo the comprehensive plan. In fact, we're starting to have work sessions along in those areas right now. One thing that I'm concerned about is property rights. I think that we need to make sure that as we move forward that we're protecting the citizens and their rights to do certain things with their properties. For example, a lady came to me and said, I'd like to build a small cottage on my property and for my mother to move in so I can watch over her and take care of her and have her close to me. And they tell me that we can't do that. And so we talked about it. We talked to staff. And even though she's not zoned for an additional building on her property, we were able to make it happen. But I think that we need, you know, government is supposed to help us and not hurt us. So I think that as we go through the comprehensive plan, we need to make sure that we're covering the priorities of the community and not just the priorities of a select few. Another part of that would be the making sure that we have the agenda of the community covered and not the agenda of staff. You know, a lot of times people can insert their own thoughts and feelings and couch it in such a way that you have a homeowner that's trying to do the right thing, but all of a sudden they find out that they're being punished for trying to do the right thing. So I think that we just need to go through it carefully, step by step, to make sure that we are covering everything as we go along.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, can you name three things you do not like about the comprehensive plan, and please describe them? Dr. Palmer.
Well, we are going through a rewrite right now, but if you look at the old comprehensive plan, it is enormous. Nobody can read it. I've tried. The natural resources portion of it was like 175 pages just alone for that. So the thing I don't like about the current one is that it's too cumbersome, that people in the community really are going to have a hard time getting through it. So that being said, there is a great effort right now going on. The Planning Commission has been dealing with this and having public hearings on this for quite a while in trying to condense that version so that it's more readable to the public. So accessibility. The second, I'm thinking about the rewrite, and I'm sort of combining the two here. I would like a little bit more specifics about groundwater protection in there, and how we're going to go about protecting natural resources with respect to commitment of clean rivers. Also, we're about to go into this. I hate to get too technical about it, but we're looking at new stormwater regulations, where we're going to have to decide how to clean up our rivers and whether we're just going to keep the rivers that are relatively clean, because it's cheaper to keep things clean than to clean things up once they've gotten dirty. So I would like more specifics in there as to how we're going to handle that. So I think those would be the three.
Thank you. We also put out a call for questions over the Internet, and the next one is one that was submitted online. And the topic is growth area boundaries. This will go first to Dr. Palmer. If you are elected or reelected, would you vote to expand the current boundaries of Albemarle's designated growth areas? Dr. Palmer.
At present, I would not. We have a lot of areas in the growth areas already that aren't being fully utilized. I don't see any reason to go outside the growth area at this point in time. There's been a lot of discussion about keeping the growth areas at the 5%. That's sort of a code word for saying we can increase them a little bit. But I'd like to concentrate on infill before we go and consider enlarging the growth area.
Thank you. Mr. Snow, if you are elected, would you vote to expand the current boundaries of Albemarle County's designated growth areas? Mr. Snow.
Dr. Palmer is correct that we've kind of taken a approach that we want to keep 95% of our county rural and the other 5% more of an urban type development. So with that in mind, just as a little side note, we've got 35 square miles of our county has 53% of our population. 690 square miles has 47% of our population. So you can see right now we're accomplishing that goal of keeping things compacted, and we try to have services for that 5%. Now, one of the things that as one of the big developments that made up that 5% was Biscuit Run. So when Biscuit Run was taken out of that mix and put into a state park, which hasn't been developed yet, that actually, and along with a couple of other projects that were now put back into, taken out of the growth area, that now reduces us down to about 4%. So I'm still for maintaining the 5% that we've talked about, but that means somewhere down the road that we can expand 1% to get it back up to 5%, which I would support.
Thank you. The third audience question will go first to Mr. Snow. The topic is arts and culture. Arts and culture leaders recently approved a new cultural plan for Charlottesville Albemarle. One goal is increased investment in the arts by local government. What do you think is the county's obligation towards funding the arts and supporting this cultural plan? Mr. Snow.
Funding the arts to me is it's important to have a vibrant art community. But I don't think it's a core function. It's not something that ranks with, you know, with the police department and the fire and rescue and things such as that. But it's a valuable part of the community because that's one of those things that makes Albemarle County and the Charlottesville area a place, you know, it's a great place to live. And so it's important. So that issue actually has come up on the board over the last 2 or 3 years. And what we've decided that we would do is recommend that the money that the tourism department is taking in through the taxes on food and meals and hotel, that a portion of that money go to help fund the art community. Art also brings a lot of people into the area in the way of tourism through the Festival of the Book, the movie. Anyhow, you know what I mean. So arts are good for the community. It's good for investments. It's good for helping it to be a quality place to live. But I don't think it's a use of tax dollars that we should take that we should invest in that area.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, arts and culture leaders recently approved a new cultural plan for Charlottesville Albemarle. One goal is increased investment in the arts by local government. What do you think is the county's obligation towards funding the arts and supporting this cultural plan? Dr. Palmer.
Well, I have to agree with Dwayne on this, that that arts are extremely important in our community. They do bring in economic development, too, where they bring people into the area. They It's extremely valuable. I definitely support supporting the arts and music in the schools. However, in a time when we're very strapped for money, I don't see it as a core, function of government, and so I'd have to look very carefully at any investments that we put into that over and above what we're already doing with the tourism money. Thank you.
Thank you. The fourth audience question will go first to Dr. Palmer. The subject is aging. How do you see the county enabling our growing senior citizen population to age in place, in particular providing access to transportation? Dr. Palmer.
What'd you say?
Well, this is something very near and dear to my heart because I have my mother here who is aging in place. I recently went to the Java for the on Friday for their it was an event where they had and his family was there selling their wares, but it was a event to expose people to different. Businesses that are helping people age in place. And but with respect to transportation, what I've seen as I'm going into the rural areas, especially in the southern part of the country, is county, is that there's an awful lot of elderly people that are trying to age in place and don't have the ability to get around and go to doctor's appointments, et cetera. So I do think that this is a is an important function for the county to support. I think the way that we would support it is predominantly through jaunt at this point and through public transportation, other public transportation options. I think that recently we have increased the fares for public transportation in the area. I think that that's counterproductive as we're trying to build our public transportation system. But with respect to aging in place, jaunt is the big one right now, and I would like to see more trips put on jaunt and I do think it's an important function for the county. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Snow, how do you see the county enabling our growing senior citizen population to age in place, in particular providing access to transportation? Mr. Snow.
I think that's a great subject, and that's something that I feel very strongly about. When Jaunt was looking for funding this past year, a lot of the adjoining counties were dropping the funding of Jaunt. And whereas the Albemarle County fully supported Jaunt and gave them what they were asking for, I know I can name three people right off the top of my head that's how they get to the doctor. That's how they get to the grocery store. And without Jaunt, a lot of these people would not have any way to get the things that they need. And if you've never looked into Jaunt, it really works pretty neat. You can call, you can make a reservation, they come pick you up, they'll take you where you need to go, and then you make an appointment to have them pick you back up and take you back home. And at the same time, they're picking up other people and working their route. But it's a very, very well-run organization, and it's sponsored by local government and state and federal government. So it's a win-win for the whole community. As far as the... another thing that I feel really strongly about, and I tried to mention that a few minutes ago, but we need to make it easier for someone that owns a piece of property and they are living on that, but they want to have a place for their mother-in-law or their mother or their father to be able to make it almost a property right. That if you have a piece of property and you're trying to add onto your house or you're trying to add a mother-in-law cottage or something to join your house or right off, to one side of it, that we make that easier for that to happen. I can't think of anything worse than that as a parent's age to have to say, well, it's either trying to find a bedroom for them or maybe move them into a nursing home. I think the more that we can keep everyone together as families, the better off we'll be. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got three more audience questions, and then the candidates will ask each other questions. This one's on the topic of the living wage. It will go first to Mr. Snow. Would you support any initiative to create a living wage standard or to raise the minimum wage? Mr. Snow.
kind of alluded to that a little bit earlier, that I think that anyone that is paying minimum wage, you're setting them up for not being able to provide for their families. But hopefully, someone that has a family is not working at minimum wage. I've got 14 grandchildren, and I'd be happy for them to get a job at any price, just to have them working and getting them to earn responsibility. And if you take away those low-paying jobs to where they're willing to have a... Do you know I've fired every one of my children that came to work for me at one time or another? They came in, they wasted a lot of time, they sat on the counter, they walked around, and one minimum wage was too much. But you have a lot of businesses that are willing to take teenagers, young teenagers, and work with them and teach them work skills. And as they develop those work skills, they become worth more money. Having been in business for 35 years, when I've got somebody that was learning and moving in and having additional talents and abilities, they didn't have to come ask me for a raise. I wanted to give them a raise. I think when you look at, to get back and answer the question specifically now about how would you feel about the...
Would you support any initiative to create a living wage standard to raise the minimum wage?
I would not support an initiative to create a higher wage so that it would exclude teenagers. I think we need that initial area. But I am for making that sure that we have good career ladder jobs here. If you have good paying jobs available, your great people are going to go there first.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, would you support any initiative to create a living wage standard or to raise the minimum wage? Dr. Palmer.
This is a really hard one. I guess it depends on the area that you're talking about. Are we talking state to state, locality to locality? We've all seen companies move from country to country looking for the lowest wages, lowest wage earners or workers. We've seen states compete for companies, and the companies move to where they can get the cheapest labor. And I certainly would be concerned if we had a wage that was higher than another area nearby us, because I would be concerned that businesses would move over the line. So that would be a big concern. I do, however, understand that you can't make a living, you can't support yourself on those kinds of low minimum wage jobs. And so we really do have to try hard to bring better jobs to the area and to give those people better educations that are in those low jobs so that they can have a hand up. And so I guess the answer would be no after all that.
Thank you. The sixth audience question is on the topic of energy. We'll go first to Dr. Palmer. What role should local government play to promote and increase the use of non-carbon renewable energy sources by county residents, businesses, and government? Dr. Palmer.
I think that one of the things that we can be, first of all, is a role model. I think that we have... we've had initiatives for the county to become more efficient. We were part of Cool Counties. We have we have dropped out of those for more what we call local initiatives. So I think that we have to be a role model and make sure that our buildings and whatnot are energy efficient, and that we are also looking to other businesses in the area to promote green energy, seeing how we can work with them to bring them into the area. I would work with the city to do that also. There's a lot of predominantly being a role model, I think, for the area. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Snow, what role should local government play to promote and increase the use of non-carbon renewable energy sources by county residents, businesses, and government? Mr. Snow.
Well, we could have everyone get a wood stove, but I don't think that works out too good. I belong to one of my responsibilities on the Board of Supervisors is to I'm working with the LEAP Board, which is a local energy alliance program. And I think that that is a great program and something that we can do as a member of the Board of Supervisors, not only to participate ourselves, but to educate people on the importance of being energy conscious. For example, when I first got on the board, I said, okay, if I'm going to be on this board, I've got to know that it works. So I asked them to come out and do an analysis of my house. Now, my house, in my opinion, was the most airtight house in the world and with lots of insulation, and I felt like there was no problem whatsoever. But they hooked up this fan to my door called the blower door test, and they shut all the windows and all the doors, and then they turned the fan on. And you stand there at the top of your steps, and you see if you can feel anything. Well, believe it or not, my hair was moving. It was amazing, you know, how inefficient my house really was. So they had me, so I came back in, and they came up with a plan for my house. I implemented that plan, and it has made a huge difference. And I think the more that we can get this message out there, that will help us to save energy and to help people to save money themselves and to help reduce our carbon footprint. Thank you.
Thank you. The last audience question, we're going to circle back to the Western Bypass. And this will go first to Mr. Snow. If you have an opportunity to insist that federal officials do a cost-benefit analysis directly comparing the proposed bypass to direct improvements to Route 29 prior to spending tax dollars to build it, would you support doing so? Mr. Snow.
Well, that goes back to the reason that I decided to run 4 years ago. You know, you can study things and keep studying them and studying them and studying them, and what have you got at the end of the day? 10 studies. And if you get depending on who you get, you can get almost anything you want at any given time. So, no, I would not go back and ask to study it again. It's been studied. We've looked at 25 different routes for a bypass, and this was the one that was chosen, not by me. It was chosen by others that were on the board at that time. And they started purchasing the land and started making this thing go forward. Now to come back in and say, well, let's go back and study it some more. You know, somewhere along the line, you've got to make a decision. And that's what I did. I believe that we made the right decision. The Daily Progress had it right. In an editorial they had a couple of years ago, they said, is this the best road? Probably not. But they said, we need to do something for the traffic that we have. The money's there. The political climate is there. And build a road. And that's the way I feel. Yeah, I mean, you go back and study this until your children are old and gray. But sometimes you've got to start making decisions and moving forward, and this is the time to do it.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, if you have an opportunity to insist that federal officials do a cost-benefit analysis directly comparing the proposed bypass to direct improvements to Route 29 prior to spending tax dollars to build it, would you support doing so? Dr. Palmer.
Yes, I would. What actually happened after the bypass was dropped several years ago was that a group of citizens, lots of different, a large group of citizens got together and worked on something called Places 29. And Places 29 developed as it came out of the Planning Commission, had a series of parallel roads and intersection improvements that actually took off just as many cars off Route 29 north as did the bypass, and it cost a lot less. And we were moving forward with that plan. It did get changed by the Board of Supervisors. Those intersection improvements got removed. But we do have a plan that we've already studied quite extensively. It's articulated in GO 29 that would be a better option. And I think we do need to study it because it would study it a little bit more, have VDOT do what they need to do with it, because they've already have looked at it to some extent. And those, it costs less. It costs $70 million less than what the bypass is going to cost. And we often hear that, you know, we got these extra roads because of the bypass. But in actuality, a lot of the Hillsdale was already funded, so was the extra lane on the Best Buy ramp. Several of these things were already funded and were going through before the bypass came back on the table. So, yes, I would. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank the audience for those great questions. We heard some tonight that we have not heard in previous forums, so I appreciate your input on those. Now we're going to turn it over to the candidates. They will get to ask each other questions, and then they'll have their closing statements. Dr. Palmer, you will get to go first, and you'll each get to ask two questions. The responses will be 2 minutes, just like the other questions. So, Dr. Palmer, you're up first.
Okay. Dwayne, you've said, and I'm happy that you have said, that you support getting up to date with our backlog on infrastructure, especially with respect to the schools. How do you plan on funding our CIP in the future? How do you what's your rate that you're going to get us back on to schedule with respect to that, and how are you going to fund it? Thank you.
I don't know that you said, do I have a rate? I don't know
rate. I'm sorry. How quickly are you planning to get us back on schedule? We're several years of backlog.
Well, I think we're going to accomplish that two different ways. One, we're going to do it by as the property tax properties go up, that will increase the revenues that we take in as far as taxes. And then as our economic development plan continues to kick in and become implemented, we will be able to have the money to put into CIP without having to go out and tax the citizens in order to come up with that money. As far as if you're asking me if I'm going to put forth a plan to raise the tax rate by 3 cents or 4 cents, no. You know, when I originally came on the board for the first time, the county executive came to me and said, a lot of people feel like we need to raise the tax rate by 6 cents to keep the CIP going. And would you support that? And I said, no. I said, there's some things that we need to do to make sure that we're starting to use our money wisely. And no, I would not support a tax increase. Now, later I did support a tax increase for our schools and for the fire station and some things that we had to have, including the Crozier Library that we had to ribbon cutting for the other day. But would I raise taxes to increase the CIP? No.
Thank you. And candidates, I like how you're looking at each other, but let's move your mics in front of you so that everyone can hear your answers. Mr. Snow, you now get to ask the first of your two questions to Dr. Palmer.
Four of the main roads that were part of Places 29 that you mentioned that, you know, was an important part of the plan that would exclude the bypass was the Hillsdale Connector, as you mentioned, and the widening of 29, the second on-ramp, and the solution for Berkmeyer Drive, the extension. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing that we were able to get. Now, you mentioned just a second ago that that all those things were already funded. Can you prove that? Because they had to go hunt for that money and to find a way to get it to us in order to make these things happen. And if they didn't do it, it took them a while to do it. So I'm just wondering how you know that.
Well, I guess, I'm sorry. Because I have been told by several people that have been working on it for many, many years that that was the case. And I guess I would have to go back and try to prove it if you'd want me to come back with that. Mr. Rooker has explained this to me on several occasions and explained to me that we've already had this money because he's been following it for many years. And so that's where I got the information from. So I'd have to, you know, proving it, I'd have to get back with you, but I'd be glad to.
I appreciate that. Thank you. All right.
I sure will. Okay.
Dr. Palmer, you now get to ask your second question, and Mr. Snow.
Okay. So in June, I'm going to read this one so I get it exactly right. On June 8th of 2011, the Board of Supervisors took a surprise vote at 11:50 at night after a long public hearing on a different matter. The next day, we all found out that the board had voted to resurrect the Western Bypass. You voted for that, as you've said. So on 6/14, the Daily Progress called the vote a show of disrespect and said, quote, the end run around the public amounts to an act of contempt for the public. This is exactly the sort of maneuvering we abhor when it occurs in the halls of Congress. It is even more appalling when it occurs at such close range, unquote. And I'd like to ask you if you think that the Daily Progress was wrong in their assessment.
Yes and no. First of all, let's go back and talk about that night. First of all, I did not change my vote. Neither did Ken change his vote. Neither did Rodney change his vote. Secretary Connaughton had called Lindsay Doyer and asked him and told him about the additional roads that they were willing to fund. That money was not there. But he said he found the money, he found a way to do it, and that he promised us that we would get these additional four roads that were a big part of Places 29 if Lindsay would support the bypass. So Lindsay had every intention of coming there that night and changing his vote at the beginning of the meeting. But ironically enough, he got caught in the traffic on 29 and got there late. The meeting had already started. And so when Mr. Doria got there, it was one of those nights where the meeting went on and on and on. And our meetings go on. Sometimes I've gotten home as late as 12:30, 1 o'clock from our meetings. So the first opportunity he had to mention that he wanted to change his vote was at the end of the meeting. And he said, I would like to change my vote. Well, like I said, I'm a consensus builder, and he's a Democrat, and he wanted to change his vote, and I didn't see any problem with that, and I felt like it was a good idea. Now, having known that it was going to be turned the midnight vote, and, you know, smoke-filled rooms, and big developers coming in, and puffing on cigars and saying, we got them. It was not that away, trust me. It was you had a Democrat, a Democrat that has served this community all of his life. And
thank you, Mr. Smith.
And it's wrong to keep doing this to him.
Mr. Snow, you now get to ask your second question of Dr. Palmer.
The other night at a previous debate, I know we've had so many, you know, we give the city $18 million of our budget every year. That's a big part of our budget, $18 million, and that's part of the revenue sharing deal that we did with the city a number of years ago. But a unintended consequences was that the composite index. The way the composite index works is that the state looks at how much money you've got, and then that's how they make a decision on how much money they're going to give your schools. So they take $18 million from the county. We give $18 million to the city. When they do the composite index, they look at it and say, okay, we're going to give you less because you've got more money. They don't take into account that we just gave the city $18 million. And so they said, we're going to give the city more because we're going to act like you didn't get that $18 million. So you made the and we've had two bills introduced over the last 2 years by Rob Bell trying to set this situation right. But when it was brought up the other night, you said I would not be interested in doing anything about the composite index because I wouldn't want to hurt our friends in the city. Why is that?
Well, that's not exactly the way I said it, but what I was implying is that, first of all, the city does have more they spend more per capita on their school children because they have a lot more children that have higher needs. And I would want very much to see how we were going to impact them and their schools before I made that kind of decision. The city is landlocked. We got into this whole agreement because they were trying to annex different parts of the county for more revenue, and we made this deal with them. So they're landlocked. They can't expand. They have to either grow up in population, but they can't get out of those boundaries. So they're limited, and we're not as limited as they are. So what I said was that I really wanted to see how it would impact those children before I made that decision, because quite frankly, I didn't know how it would impact those children. And I think making a decision before you know how people are really going to be felt, you know, how they're going to feel, and how you're going to strap that school system would be inappropriate.
One follow-up question. So our schools don't matter?
Of course our schools matter. Of course our schools matter. But you have been going on about how we're going to increase our economic development and how we're going to do all these things. We can grow out. We've just put in stone fields. We've done an awful lot, and we have more area to grow in, and more resources. And so all I'm saying is I would like to see how it impacts the city before I made that kind of decision.
Thank you, candidates. We are going to finish tonight with our closing statements. Dr. Palmer, you get to go first. You will have 3 minutes.
Okay. Well, I'm very happy that we had this and that we're all finished, and I'm very impressed.
Amen.
First of all, I'm really been very impressed at how this community is interested in local government. I'm looking out at this crowd, and there's an awful lot of people that came tonight, and I think that's really wonderful. I think that I'm really looking forward to getting on with this campaign, and one of the things that going to all these forums has been very interesting, but what I really love to do is go door to door. And so I'm very excited about finishing up with all the forums so that I can get back out and really start to meet more people in the community. And I'm really looking forward to serving this community. I have a lot of energy, I have a lot of enthusiasm, and a lot to give, and I'm looking forward to serving. And I really want to assure everyone that if I am elected, I'm going to dedicate myself to maintaining the public trust by involving citizens in the work of the county. And I hope that when and if I do get elected, that I've got lots of people to help on all the committees that need to be manned and all the boards that need to be manned, because I really need all the input from citizens of this community. And I'm very much interested in listening to everyone's concerns. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Palmer. Mr. Snow, you now have 3 minutes for a closing statement.
I, too, would like to thank Daily Progress and Charlottesville Tomorrow for hosting this event tonight. And again, thank all of you for coming and being a part of this. I don't know how much you learned, but it was great being here. You know, as I look forward to the next 4 years, I'm thinking about the things that we need to do. I think we've come a long ways at accomplishing things that we set out to do, you know, create an economic development plan, working on keeping our taxes low. Over the last 4 years, the tax burden, the amount of money that you pay for your taxes has consistently gone down for 4 years. I think that we've been managing our money in the county extremely well. We have a AAA bond rating, which enables us to get the money that we need for infrastructure at the very, very best rate that you can get money at. But we still have a lot of work to do. And one of the things that's at the top of my list, you know, I've kind of been working on it for the last 2 or 3 years, kind of halfway. You know, I bring it up at a meeting, and they said, well, we're studying it, and we're going to get it done. But I found that we're moving back into the same trap that that I was criticizing those that were building the roads or trying to build roads, you know, just, okay, we'll work on it, but not really getting anything done. And that's to get cell coverage and Internet coverage out into our county. There's a lot of people that go home at night, and it's like going back into another century. I mean, they've got a dial-up phone, but they are unable to communicate, to answer their emails, unless it goes to satellite. And satellite, if you're on satellite, from what I'm told, it's slow and it's expensive. So that is going to be one of my top priorities this next 4 years, is to get Internet coverage and cell coverage out into all parts of the county. That is a top priority. I'm putting together a committee. We're attacking it from two different positions, and you will see movement on that within the next 6 months, if not before. I think that I was doing a ride-along with the police officer last week, week before last, Officer Massad, Karen Massad. She's extremely efficient and good at what she does. But she was telling me that if you get back up into in the certain pockets of our county, that there's no... she does not have any contact with her, with the rest of the station, or with any, or any of the other cars. And so, you know, not having internet and cell coverage is a safety situation for our police officers, our first responders, and for our children, and our those that are trying to age in place. So, to me, that is a top priority. And I give you my word, you will see movement on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's give both these candidates a round of applause.
Thank you.